Before I start, I think I should say that I am appearing before you today under slightly false pretenses. Although I was in my day a prize catechumen, I am not a biblical scholar. And although Brent's struggles with Matthew 18 have something to do with what I am saying today, as indicated in the title, it's not my major point, and my paper is not constructed about that. I am really interested in Brent's as an ecclesiastical organizer of the state church in the 16th century, and because in this particular aspect of his work he got into a quarrel over Matthew 18 or got into a particularly fruitless struggle to apply it, the program committee, faced with a hopeless task of finding some place to put me on this program, decided that I fit here as well as I would any place else. So with that said, I shall begin. Ecclesiastical discipline is the one area of church order in which Johannes Brentz, who was one of the most important architects of the 16th century Lutheran territorial state church, signally failed to achieve his purposes. During his career in the imperial city of Schwäbisch Hall, where he was from 1522 to 1548, and later in the Duchy of Württemberg, where he worked from 1550 until his death in 1570, Brentz tried repeatedly, but ultimately without success, to establish an order of ecclesiastical discipline which would include effective use of the penalty of excommunication. An examination of the reasons for this failure may throw some light on the limits of what could be achieved, what was possible within the context of the state church. I should add here parenthetically, however, that my real reason for being interested in this topic is that I am not entirely happy with the contributions that my German colleagues, both past and present, have made to it. Though I have learned a good deal from them, they have, in my opinion, ignored some of the relevant evidence and misinterpreted some of the rest. Because of a lack of time, I shall make no attempt this morning to justify my conclusions over against theirs. If you're interested in that, I refer you to the forthcoming published version of this paper. The means of discipline which the reformers relied upon most heavily were persuasive rather than coercive in character. That is, on preaching, pastoral counseling, and catechetical instruction. But there were bound to be persons who obstinately and knowingly persisted in publicly scandalous conduct despite the application of these persuasive measures. And since, in the view of the reformers, such persons could not be tolerated in the church, and since the pastors could not knowingly admit them to the sacrament without becoming accomplices in the sin of unworthy communion, the reformers recommended for such extreme cases the more drastic discipline of excommunication. Medieval practice had distinguished between two sorts of excommunication, the lesser and the greater, the excommunicatio minor and the excommunicatio major. The lesser ban deprived a person temporarily of the sacraments. The greater cut him off from Christian society altogether, so that, for example, the faithful were forbidden to associate with him, Christian burial was denied him. Furthermore, canon law required the state to impose secular outlawry on the person thus expelled from the Christian community, as the state, of course, eventually did in Luther's case. It is worth remembering also that in the pre-Reformation period, excommunication, along with the interdict, had been so fearfully abused for financial and political reasons that laymen tended to despise it as a means whereby the clergy exploited them. So it was going to be very difficult, at best, for the reformers to get their followers to view excommunication as a necessary component of church order. Luther's Schmalkaldic Articles of 1537 rejected the greater excommunication as a purely secular penalty, whose use was therefore inappropriate in the church, and only the lesser excommunication was acknowledged as a means whereby obstinate public sinners could be barred from the sacraments in the church until they changed their way of life. And although the confessional writings assigned the exercise of this lesser ban directly to the pastors, Luther subsequently argued that scripturally they ought to exercise it only in consultation with the congregation, and expressed his strong disapproval when secular authorities attempted to assert control over the clergy in the matter of excommunication. Although Brentz, along with the other leading Lutheran reformers, signed the Schmalkaldic Articles, they are not, as a matter of fact, an accurate indication of his own views on the subject of excommunication, as we shall presently see. Brentz's first effort in the field of ecclesiastical discipline was an unsuccessful attempt to bring about the establishment of a Protestant ecclesiastical court modeled on the old Episcopal Synod or Synodal Court, Cent or Centgericht in Brentz's German. The word synod, the only English translation, can of course be used to refer to any solemn ecclesiastical assembly, but in this paper I'm using the term exclusively in the sense of an ecclesiastical court. Brentz's first proposal for the establishment of a synod is contained in one of the sections of a lengthy memorandum presented to the City Council of Schwäbisch Hall in the spring of 1527 and setting forth in detail the proposals which he wanted to see incorporated into the Hall Church order of that year. Secular government, said Brentz, whether it be heathen or Christian, is an ordinance of God for the purpose of punishing evil and rewarding good in order that decency and honor be maintained in civic affairs. In New Testament times, there were no Christian rulers, with the consequence that many public sins went unpunished. And since Christians could not exercise the power of the sword against these offenses, Christ himself established the method whereby the church could deal with public offenders in its midst. As recorded in Matthew 18, here slightly abridged, if thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. But if he will not hear thee, then take with thee one or two more. And if he shall neglect to hear them, tell it unto the church. But if he neglect to hear the church, let him be unto thee as an heathen man and a publican. The saints of the early church, Brentz continued, citing 1 Corinthians and Titus, exercised excommunication in the following manner. In each congregation or parish, several elderly, experienced, brave, honest men were elected, one to serve as pastor and the others to be presbyters or counselors. When pastors and presbyters met to conduct church business, this was known as a synod, that is, an assembly. The duties of the synod were to see that the congregation was regularly provided with the word of God and the sacraments, and to administer ecclesiastical discipline in the case of public misconduct by any member of the congregation. If, after several admonitions, the guilty person were still impenitent, he was publicly excommunicated, that is, barred from the sacrament until he regained admittance to the Christian community through improvement of life and public confession. Meanwhile, everybody was to avoid his company while praying for his repentance. Well, nowadays, said Brentz, and you will note in passing the kind of historically relativizing attitude toward the text, nowadays, said Brentz, it is much easier to maintain decent conduct among Christian people, since the secular sword is now in the hands of Christian rulers who use their authority to this end. Nevertheless, there are many grievous sins which, because they arouse no particular public disorder, are either not prohibited by law, or else the extant laws are negligently enforced. For example, swearing and cursing, envy and hatred, gluttony and drunkenness, fornication, gambling, usury, and the like. Furthermore, even when the secular government does administer penalties, genuine repentance and improvement of life do not necessarily result. Consequently, if the evil behavior of a few Christians is not to bring disgrace upon an entire congregation, as well as on the good name of Christianity, and if the sacrament is not to be desecrated by the participation of the notoriously unworthy, the church has to employ some means either to bring such persons to repentance, or if they remain unrepentant, to excommunicate them. Well, Brentz took the historically inaccurate view that the medieval synodal courts were a continuation of the synods of the early church, insofar as the latter had functioned as organs of ecclesiastical discipline. And Brentz now wanted to establish a useful Christian synod, as he called it, in place of the corrupt papal one. He therefore urged that the city council appoint several honest persons from the citizenry who, when need arose, would join with the pastor and the preacher, that is Brentz himself, to hold a synod, dealing only with the cases of persons guilty of such public sins as were not punished by the secular authorities, or persons still impenitent after the imposition of secular penalties. The synod was to admonish and, if necessary, to excommunicate the guilty party according to the procedure outlined above. Significantly, Brentz also recommended that this same group, which functioned as an organ of ecclesiastical discipline, also serve as the body through which special matters not covered in the church order be referred to the city council for its consideration and decision. This notion of a single body competent both in the area of ecclesiastical administration as well as of ecclesiastical discipline is one which will recur in Brentz's thought. It will recur again in this paper also, so bear it in mind. The 1527 proposal has frequently been misinterpreted as evidence that Brentz was at this point a champion of congregational self-regulation in matters of ecclesiastical discipline and in other matters. That is, he was a champion of synodal polity in the strictest sense of the word. All the other evidence, however, before, during, and after 1527 overwhelmingly contradicts that interpretation. Brentz was, from the beginning, a consistent advocate of the state church, a consistent centralizer who never championed congregational rights. In fact, he ceaselessly campaigned against them. In the 1527 proposal, Brentz was interested in the biblical evidence cited, not because of its possible congregationalist implications, but because he wanted to prove that excommunication was a thing commanded by Christ and necessary to the church, and to bolster the allegation that the synodal courts had their roots in Christian antiquity, not in the more recent machinations of the papal antichrist. The synod proposed in 1527 was clearly not a very close copy of the old episcopal courts. The name and the function were the same, but Brentz omitted the elaborate judicial procedures and retained only the penalty of excommunication. In 1531, on the other hand, Brentz proposed that the rampant immorality, that's his description, in Hall's rural districts be dealt with by means of a synod whose procedures and penalties were closely modeled on those of the old episcopal synod. The basic argument in 1531 is the same as that in 1527. The government does not punish certain sins which the church cannot ignore. Thus, in the absence of an order of ecclesiastical discipline, the clergy are forced to give communion to the unworthy, who, in the absence of secular or ecclesiastical penalties, show no improvement of life and are a continuing source of scandal. To cope with this situation, each parish ought to be visited every year by a commission of three or four men, comprising theologians and lawyers, appointed by the city council for that purpose. Dealing only with public sins and scrupulously avoiding interference where secular penalties had been applied with the desired effect, the commissioners were to hear the sworn testimony of local witnesses regarding all public sins and injustices. Where appropriate, they were to impose punishments which ranged from payment of fines to the church's poor chest in all cases, through several days fast on bread and water, to public excommunication in particularly obstinate cases. The defensive tone of certain passages in both proposals indicates that Brentz was aware of strong opposition to them. In 1527, for example, he felt constrained to argue that he was not trying to turn the city into a monastery, but rather into a disciplined citizenry, and to observe further that Christ was certainly not drunk when he instituted excommunication. However, neither the welcome assurance of Brentz's freedom from monkish tendencies nor the comforting news that the Savior never drank while on duty was sufficient to overcome the opposition to the synod. Neither of the proposal of 1527 nor that of 1531 nor anything like it was adopted. The reason was quite simple: the adamant opposition of the secular rulers, doubtless supported by public opinion insofar as such a thing existed and found open expression. It is true that the members of both synods were to be appointed by the city council, and that in certain respects both synods resembled institutions which eventually became component parts of the state church. The synod of 1527 resembles the later commissions whose competence included both enforcement of the church orders and the authority to excommunicate, while the synod of 1531 resembles the later visitation commissions. However, in their original form, they could only be viewed by the magistrates as a threat to themselves. The entire emphasis was on the synod as a church court distinct from the secular courts and as an organ which the church could use when in its judgment such use was necessary and proper. There was no mention of magisterial review and confirmation of its sentences. Brentz's deliberate copying of the name and the procedures of the hated Episcopal courts can only have confirmed the impression that he was attempting to reassert clerical jurisdiction in affairs that had with great difficulty been brought under the jurisdiction of the magistrates in the decades before the Reformation. His disclaimer of any intention to interfere in the workings of the secular courts was doubtless sincere, but the functioning of synodal courts alongside the secular courts could only have resulted in the sort of jurisdictional quarrels which had rent the air of the pre-Reformation period, if only because laymen would certainly have appealed to the secular magistrates against the sentence of a church court. Certainly there was a Philibert Berthelier living somewhere in Schwäbisch Hall, just as he was living in several other places. Thus, even though Brentz's charge that the secular authorities were lax in enacting and enforcing appropriate legislation was doubtless well-founded, the magistrates were not on that account willing to surrender part of their jurisdiction, which they regarded as indivisible, to a church court. Brentz had no other choice then but to call upon the secular authorities to do a better job of exercising their jurisdiction. In the Hall Church Order of 1527, which was promulgated by Brentz in a series of sermons which have just recently been rediscovered, there is no mention of the synod that Brentz had proposed. Instead, Brentz had to proclaim and to elucidate a new version of an old pre-Reformation governmental mandate against blasphemy, drunkenness, gluttony, fornication, and similar offenses. From the mandate, we learn that one of the more appealing forms of vice in Schwäbisch Hall was the holding of elaborate Sunday morning breakfasts at which great quantities of brandy were consumed to the great detriment of body and soul. In the section of the church order dealing with the Holy Communion, the pastors were conceded a watered-down version of the lesser ban, that is, the right to admonish, and only to admonish, not to exclude, those guilty of public offenses not to partake of the Lord's Supper until genuine repentance and improvement of life had taken place. The church order did not provide for any formal public excommunication in any form. The 1531 proposal, too, was soon abandoned after Brentz vainly defended it against the charge of being an uncalled-for outrage and a manifestation of popish tendencies. The proposed ordinance was dated 28 January 1531. Soon thereafter, at the latest by mid-February, Brentz had sent a copy of it to Margrave George of Brandenburg-Ansbach, strongly urging its inclusion in the church order, which Brandenburg and the city of Nuremberg were preparing to issue in common. But within a few weeks, Brentz had evidently accepted defeat once again, and was content to urge the secular authorities to get busy and do an adequate job of performing the task they had insisted upon reserving to themselves. So when in August 1531, Brentz again wrote to Margrave George, advising him on measures to curb the profligate lives of the common herd, das Gemeinpöbel, he made no mention of any synod, but recommended that apart from provision for true preaching, the best thing for the Margrave to do would be to see to it that his officials actually enforced the mandates already issued against cursing, blasphemy, immoderate drinking, and the like, especially when the pastors sought their help in this regard. Similarly, when in 1534 the Reformation was introduced into the Duchy of Württemberg, the Duke assumed direct responsibility for policing public immorality, as his predecessors had done, and in 1535 Brentz advised the Duke that one of the tasks of the proposed annual visitation ought to be to determine whether or not the ducal officials were diligent in carrying out this responsibility. Well, while it is true that Brentz had abandoned the effort to establish a church court, other evidence makes it clear that while Brentz may have abandoned this attempt, he had by no means abandoned his demand that a viable order of excommunication be established. The evidence is found in a memorandum written by Brentz in December 1531 in the course of the deliberations on the above-mentioned Brandenburg-Nuremberg church order. Brentz participated several times on the Ansbach side in the deliberations on that order. There's no time now to tell a rather long and interesting story of how this memorandum came to be written. It's one which I think my colleagues in Germany have not paid enough attention to. the message, what Brentz had to say can briefly be summarized as follows. Public excommunication, he said, can be exercised in the church, in der Kirchen, only if there are church courts which base their findings on the careful examination of evidence supplied by witnesses. Excommunication by the pastor alone, on the basis of his own personal knowledge and judgment, is neither fair nor proper. Since it was clear that neither the magistrates nor the public were prepared to tolerate an independent church court, Brentz concluded that the administration of excommunication in the church was not possible, considering the great state of disarray in the affairs of the church. Determined, nevertheless, that excommunication must be administered, he proposed that the power to do so be given to the body that was to be set up by the magistrates to enforce the church order. Well, this, it seems to me, is Brentz's 1527 synod all over again, but stripped of its offensive name or of any other features suggesting relationship to the old episcopal courts, and devoid of any other suggestion that it would interfere in the jurisdiction of the secular courts. And this marks Brentz's definitive acknowledgement of the fact that the hope for a church court was illusory, and the beginning of his efforts to secure the administration of excommunication by a body exercising magisterial authority. But for the time being, even this modification of his demands was not sufficient to overcome the prejudice of the secular officials against excommunication in any form. And in none of the four church orders with which Brentz was associated prior to 1550, with any provision made for public excommunication. Ecclesiastical discipline consisted exclusively in the same right of private admonition which had been conceded to the pastors in the Hall Church Order of 1527. Well, we switch now to the later period in Württemberg. The ways and means whereby ecclesiastical discipline were to be administered in the Württemberg Church are contained in several ordinances, most of which, especially those dealing with the imposition of excommunication, were not published until 1559. We know, however, from Brentz's own writings that the system was in all essential respects complete and in operation by sometime in 1554 at the latest. And to understand how the system operated, it is necessary to know a bit about the organs of church government through which it was administered. The central governing body of the church was known as the consistory. It really was known as the Kirchenrat at this time, but consistorium came to be the name later on. Central governing body was the consistory, which formed a part of the Duke's Privy Council. The membership of the consistory consisted of four secular counselors and four theologians, including Brentz, who had the title of supreme theological advisor. The connecting link between the consistory and the local parishes was an official known as the superintendent, who was appointed from among the pastors in each of approximately 28 local districts. And the superintendent's principal duty was to conduct a visitation of every parish in his district at least once a year, to report matters requiring immediate attention to the consistory in Stuttgart, and to submit written reports of each visitation to his immediate superior, known as the general superintendent, of which there were four, also clergymen. Twice a year, the general superintendents met with the members of the consistory in Stuttgart to deliberate on the contents of the visitation reports. Whereas the day-to-day administration of the church was in the hands of the consistory, this special body, which was formed by the addition of the general superintendents to the consistory, had two special duties. First was legislative, to recommend to the Duke whatever new legislation or other measures the need of which had been revealed by the visitations. And second, to function as the only body authorized to impose the penalty of excommunication. The church order referred to this body as the conventus, but it soon came to be called the synodus, the synod, and that name stuck to it. It is the realization of the proposal first made in the Hall Church Order of 1527, and then again in revised form in the memorandum of December 1531. The order of ecclesiastical censure, which culminated in the imposition of excommunication by the synod, was the complement of those sections of the Landesordnung, the territorial ordinance of 1552, which provided secular penalties for public offenses against Christian morality. In the event that the secular authorities were lax in enforcing the law, or that secular penalties brought no improvement in the life of the person affected, procedures modeled on those outlined in Matthew 18 were to be applied. First, the pastor could reprove the guilty person and admonish him not to commune. If this had no effect, the pastor was to tell it to the church, that is, report the matter to his superintendent. If the sinner did not respond to the admonitions of the superintendent, accompanied by the pastor and two judges of the local court, there are the two others of the text, he could be haled before the synod and excommunicated with the prior knowledge and consent of the duke. The excommunicated person was barred from the sacrament and from all other Christian ceremonies except the sermon. If he died without repenting, he was not to receive Christian burial. Furthermore, the local sub-prefect was to bar him from all weddings, taverns, and other social gatherings, while all social intercourse with him, save only those business dealings necessary to keep him fed and clothed, was banned. This was, of course, not the lesser ban acknowledged by the Lutheran confessional writings, but a form of the greater ban, that is, including secular penalties, which was condemned in them. Hardly had this plan been established when, in the summer of 1554, Jakob Andreje, who was pastor in Göppingen and a general superintendent, and his brother-in-law, Kaspar Leiser, who was a pastor in Nürtingen, came forward with an alternate proposal. They had come into possession of a book by Pierre Viret, the Calvinist reformer of Lausanne, describing the exercise of excommunication by a consistory of 6 or 8 persons, chosen in part from the clergy and in part from the laity, which met once a week to admonish public sinners and to excommunicate those who failed to heed admonition. Finding this plan indeed pious in accordance with Scripture, Leiser and Andreje appealed to the Duke for permission to put it into practice in their congregations. Well, strange to say, Duke Christopher was initially in favor of this bit of creeping Calvinism, with all its overtones of congregational autonomy and decentralization, while Brentz vehemently opposed it and soon browbeat the prince into ordering Leiser and Andreje to abide by the established order of ecclesiastical censure. This seems all the more strange when you consider the fact that what Leiser and Andreje proposed was an independent church court similar to that proposed by Brentz himself in 1527. The prince seemed well disposed. Was this then not the golden opportunity for Brentz to realize his original intentions? Well, Brentz didn't think so. First of all, he objected to the notion of a congregational consistory. Throughout his whole career, Brentz had consistently sought to concentrate all decision-making authority in the hands of the central organs of church government, regarding local pastors and their congregations as seedbeds of disorder that had to be controlled and regulated from above. He was not now about to consent to the exercise of anything so important as excommunication by congregational bodies. He attempted to bolster his stand with the argument that in the ancient church, consistories had not been established in every little town or village, but only in the more important cities where bishops and their chapters resided. That is, not in Göppingen and Nürtingen, but in Stuttgart. But Brentz's more fundamental objection to the Leiser-Andreje proposal was that it represented an attempt to substitute an obviously unworkable plan for one which had at least a chance of success. Before discussing the argument behind this objection, I have to make a necessary oral footnote, about the terminology which Brentz uses. Brentz's statement of his reasons for rejecting the Leiser-Andreje proposal is the only instance, as far as I am aware, in which he uses the terms excommunicatio minor and excommunicatio major and defines them. Normally, he just refers to the ban and assumes that you know what he means. His use of the term excommunicatio major can mislead you if you're not careful. It misled me for several years and continues to confuse my colleagues in Tübingen. As I have already noted, the form of excommunication established in the Württemberg Church Order corresponds to what the confessional writings referred to as the greater excommunication. However, when Brentz uses the term excommunicatio major in this particular argument, he does not mean that. It is clear from the context that he uses the term to mean public excommunication by a church court, as opposed to the established order of public excommunication by the authority of the prince. He places the two things in clear opposition to one another. He says, we've got the one and we can't have the other. So now for the argument, which, as you will readily see, is essentially the same as that in the Ansbach Memorandum of 1531. Brentz admits that in Matthew 18, Christ established excommunication in the church. Brentz then goes on to distinguish between the sort of excommunication which can be exercised by the individual pastor and that which can only be exercised by the church in general. The individual pastor is entitled to impose the lesser ban, by which he means the right to admonish impenitent sinners not to commune. This form of excommunication, he says, is adequately provided for in the church order, and it is the Duke's will that all pastors diligently make use of it. Public exclusion from the sacrament, which Brentz calls excommunicatio major, is a much more difficult and complicated matter. In the past, a person publicly excommunicated was considered incapable of testifying in court, of inheriting property, or of holding any honorable office. Such a penalty, said Brentz, must never be imposed by a single pastor privato suo arbitrio. It can only properly be imposed by church courts according to an orderly judicial process and on the basis of special laws or canons defining the offenses under its jurisdiction and the procedures it is to follow. Well, said Brentz, owing to the condition of these times, it has not been possible to establish this exercise of the excommunicatio major. Therefore, in order that scandalous vices not remain unpunished, the Duke has established both secular and ecclesiastical penalties, including the imposition of excommunication by the synod ex permissu et concessione principis. This, Brentz insisted, is as fitting and sufficient a provision for the discipline of morals according to the rule of Christ in Matthew 18 as is possible at the present time. If the sacrament is still being polluted by the unworthy communion of impenitent sinners, the fault, said Brentz, lies not in any shortcomings in the relevant ordinances, but in the failure of the secular officials and the pastors to enforce them properly. To attempt to replace this established order of ecclesiastical discipline with the exercise of the excommunicatio major would, under the circumstances, be a strange and dangerous innovation, which would give rise to much resentment and disorder, and thus could not profitably be carried into effect. Well, substantially the same argument is to be found in Brentz's commentary on Matthew 18, published in the same year. I'm running a little bit over time, so I'll just leave that out. It's the same thing all over again, but in somewhat more vague language. Well, since Brentz had always acknowledged the right and duty of the Christian magistrate to govern the affairs of the church, it can be said that the views expressed in 1554, which were an elaboration of the stand taken in 1531, fit his own conception of the state church rather more neatly than did the original demand for an independent church court. On the other hand, that original demand was not really inconsistent with his view of the Christian magistracy. The demand for a synod had stemmed not from any dogmatic assertion that ecclesiastical discipline was something that the magistrate had no right to interfere in. Never seems to have conceived of it as an inalienable part of the ministry of the word. Not as something that the magistrate had no right to interfere in, but rather from the perception of a wide gap between what the church needed in the realm of moral discipline and what the magistrate seemed willing to do. Brentz wanted to bridge that gap with the church court, but as soon as he discovered that this means to his end was impossible of achievement, he changed his tactics without abandoning his goal or betraying any sacred principle. It can also be said that Brentz was absolutely right in 1554 as in 1531 in his insistence that the independent exercise of excommunication by the church was impossible in the face of the opposition to it. When in 1557 the idea of an independent church court came up again for consideration, and it was the Duke that brought it up, one of Duke Christopher's jurists pointed out that the Duke's courtiers and his officials would never submit themselves to the judgment of such a court, and that the populace too would sooner engage in rebellion than submit to it. So if the Duke wanted to reign in peace and be served by loyal officials, he had best stick to the established form of ecclesiastical censure. The Duke followed that advice. Well, alas, for poor old Brentz. The order of excommunication, which fit his conception of the state church so nicely, and which he had correctly seen as the only possible one, did not work. The reason, as Brentz himself pointed out a number of times, was the passive resistance of the local magistrates, without whose cooperation the sentence of excommunication could not be enforced. The synod could and did impose sentences of excommunication until they were blue in the face, but the sentences were never carried out at the local level. As a consequence, the sentenced persons persisted in their wicked ways, so that they were called before the synod time after time for repetitions of the same offense. Same old group of whores and gamblers and fornicators twice a year. This meant that the synod, as Brentz complained bitterly in 1565, was so overburdened with matters of ecclesiastical discipline that it could not perform its other duties and had become a laughingstock. None of the proposed changes of procedure anyone could dream up had any bearing on the central problem, namely that of enforcement. If it was clear in 1554 that the Duke's officials were not enforcing the relevant ordinances, it was clear in 1565 that they would not, and that there was nothing anyone could do about it. No one even had the heart to try anymore. So the net result of Brentz's 40-year-long confrontation with the problem of ecclesiastical discipline was the bitter realization that a consistent and orderly administration of it was not possible in the context of the state church, as the Anabaptists kept reminding him, even with the active support and goodwill of the supreme magistrate. In every other area of church order, the interests of the lay community and of the ecclesiastical establishment were in more or less perfect harmony. Public worship, education, ecclesiastical administration, social welfare. Consequently, the state church worked well from the point of view of both parties, and of course Brentz was not willing to abandon it in the face of Anabaptist criticism just because its means of ecclesiastical discipline were deficient. But in this case of ecclesiastical discipline, the lay community would have no part of what the ecclesiastical establishment wanted to impose upon them, either in Brentz's version or indeed in that of Weiser and Andreae. They were no more willing to submit to the imposition of excommunication by the fiat of Duke Christopher of Württemberg any more than they had been willing to submit to the reinstitution of Catholicism in 1548 to 1550 by fiat of Charles V. I suppose there is some lesson to be learned there about the limits of mere power, mere fiat, in such matters. And I think it's true that Brentz was guilty of trying to impose upon the lay community by the authority of the state something that he had not been able to get them to accept by the force of his arguments in his preaching or in his theological writings. He failed, and I myself think it was probably a good thing that he did. Thank you.
We have 10 minutes apparently for discussion. What questions have you? Mr. Green.
I have two questions relating to Hitler and Brentz, rather closely related. One, what little I have done in the area of Wittenberg history, thank you very much. I have the understanding are the visitation reports lost?
I haven't been able to find them.
I have read that I think that they were systematically destroyed or disappeared or something like this.
A lot of things were carted off in the course of the 30 Years' War and maybe in unfiled boxes someplace in the Escorial.
And even in the Latinx
days. And in World War I, a lot of church records were taken and pounded down from pulp to make paper. One doesn't have the records of the synod either. All one has are some records of the things that he decided in the late 17th century kind of handbook for the government of the church. No, it would be extremely valuable what happens if they're not there.
Then the second part, which is closely related, I have been going through Burkhardt's history of the assassination in 1625 to 1645. I was just wondering what you think about this. The visitors, there we do have some of the records, the visitors complain continuously about the low moral standard. Is this low moral standard. The result of the freedom, of the Reformation, or is it the continuation of the medieval canon? And is the complaint due to the standard of the one doing the complaining and the visitor? Or has conditions been progressed very badly?
Well, I can give you Brent's answer to that question. He wrote a memorandum on it around 1526. He complained that in the city wall, inside the city wall, which even under the papacy, there's been a lot of preaching because the city council, you know, appointed pastors for preaching, that even though people were crammed together in close quarters, they lived with relative public order. But in the countryside, where, as he's saying, now they've been deprived of preaching, hadn't been raised with proper instruction, the behavior of the people was wild. They usually referred specifically to weddings and church dedications, or the anniversaries of church dedications. I don't know much about, I haven't studied much on the holidays in the countryside, but these things apparently lasted several days. A great deal of alcohol was consumed, and things got pretty rough. He complained that somebody was always murdered or maimed at a church dedication or a wedding reception. two things were necessary: proper preaching and good schools.
You go to a Kirchweih Fest today in Europe, in Germany. I know in Erlangen it lasted a week, and the four local brewers brought out their product, and it was the annual folk festival. I find exactly the same thing in the Saxon tradition. The cities aren't so bad, but the villages and churches. You can't hardly believe your eyes, some of you read.
He complains that neither the church nor the state has paid much attention to these people, except in terms of collecting the dues from them. That no, in typical human fashion, you know, they have not been given a proper moral education. Which probably is true.
A lot of room here.
Yes.
All right, from the back, Gilson.
I get the impression from your remarks on Brennan, we didn't address in the top of the head, he regarded that communication almost solely the judicial act and not the prior.
Oh, well, you mean the
Calvin, yes, for the effort to bring the person back to the church. But Calvin would never allow communication to be declared in the church.
Well, no, I think Brent thought of it as a means of strict, the lesser ban, that is private admission. Your aim is to bring him back, but he has this kind of attitude that they won't respond to, pure admonition, that you humiliate them and dragoon them into coming back. I think an exaggeration of what can be achieved simply by knocking people around by the authority of the magistrate, especially when they're initially opposed to the whole idea. Anyway, he thought of it as bringing them back to the faith, but by particularly severe means. What he did think was that you don't publicly excommunicate a man. I mean, this automatically involves, in his mind, he's continuing to admit evil tradition, automatically involves social disgrace. He doesn't accept the argument somebody like Osiander uses in Nuremberg, that it is a purely spiritual penalty. It does involve the social disgrace of the person involved. It has economic and social consequences for him. And therefore, you do not submit him to this except by a procedure which is what one might call an anachronistic term, due process. You can't leave some local pastor in his excessive zeal and in his ignorance to, split his congregation and cause a hubbub by excommunicating somebody in the full public sense of religion by publicly denying him the sacrament. He feared disorder more than he feared pollution of the sacrament.
There's a question in connection with this. He and his use of Matthew 18, is there any appeal theologically, like on the basis of 1 Corinthians 11, dealing with the question of worthy and unworthy communicants? Is this his basis for it?
I don't really know the answer to that question. Certainly that is the whole conception of worthy and unworthy communicants is involved there. On the other hand, Brent is using it as argument, and he would know more than I have, that Brent's demand for this kind of order of ecclesiastical discipline
is not really integrally related to his theology. It doesn't grow out of some theological premise. It grows out of what is probably his humanist notion that what church and state are there for is to promote the gemeinnutz, publica, tranquilitas, ordo, and all of that. And it's less a result of biblical insight than your determination to make everybody behave in a preconceived pattern of people in the terms that were presented by Captain Meeting, he'd wedded himself to the Renaissance state. He found out the Renaissance state was not capable of giving him the spirit of commonwealth, which he also wanted. So, in that conversation, I don't know what the relation of this demand is to any fundamental theological proposition. One scholar has said that there isn't any, that's all I can tell.
All right, you and then Mr. Sir.
I'd like to address the question to Father Wink. Does Penny deal with Chesham's significant charge that Luther's teaching about reflective faith, you didn't use the term, but I think that is the correct term, is constructing a new church? And if so, how does Penny deal with this argument?
Well, Haig's treatment is practically simply a report, and at that, I think he's somewhat misled by the framework of argumentation that Gadsden can use. It's some technical terms that come in, but no, he really doesn't take up, for instance, he misses the simple direct statement of Cajetan and in the Scholastic Quaestio, the real nub, this comes immediately after the opinion to the contrary, and as the word Cajetan says simply, in oppositum est sensus is communin, sensus ecclesiae. And then later on, he refers to the practice of the faithful. And this bears a far greater weight, I believe, in Cajetan's argumentation than Hennig realizes or admits. He does have a great deal, sort of field day with contritionism, getting into some of the late medieval disputes, patrician, contrition. Really, this specific little, this is practically an aside towards the end of the Quaestio. And I really don't think it comes to term anyway with the argument of the Quaestio.
It may be an aside, but it is a very weakening charge. Whether
there has
been any notice taken in
Hennig
or any of the other literature that
you have. It's been noted by Hennig, but not particularly at all. Mr. Esther,
I wanted to question a little more in general about discipline within Lutheranism on the basis of France. Yet you seem to be saying that he would base it perhaps on medieval patterns or on biblical evidence, or maybe on humanism.
Is there any evidence of Calvinistic influence coming into France? To what degree is there a relation between Calvinism and Calvinism? I know of no evidence of Calvinism, because I know there's only one letter ever exchanged between them.
But then the array coming in.
Well, I mean, that was the people that he was trying to sit on in 1554.
He didn't even agree, is there strong disciplinary commitment within Luther's performance?
There certainly is in Brent, stronger than in Luther, I have a feeling, judging from Mr. Gritz's little book, on how Luther exercised that communication, hardly at all. In 1543, when Marcus Saxony tried to introduce an order of excommunication under the authority of Prince Luther, complained bitterly to the pastors of Dresden about it. I really only suspect there are other things about Brent that I trace specifically to his humanist background. From my first article about relationship between church and state and Christian magistrate and all of that. Whether that is true also in the case of discipline, I can't tell.
Well, what about Boots are fitting in there now? Boots are in French, we're all associated.
I'm not just in Boots, I refer to Professor Kittleson about Boots there. I haven't got to the point of studying him yet.
I would detail on this point. Yeah, I would start by your remark that the French is trying to reform society, whether it wants to or not. And this is pretty much the question of Boots. If the old desire for a moral reform that was part of, well, standard late medieval reform.
It seems to me that if French really wanted to do that, he should have taken a more absolute attitude toward the text. He should not have taken the fangs out of it that he does in the commentary of 1554 by making it historically relative. He almost said in 1527 that Christ established excommunication in the church only because there wasn't a Christian magistrate around to do it, which robbed it of some measure of divine force or necessity in the church. And in 1554, says it's the other way around. This order in Matthew 18 applies only to Christ's immediate disciples and the isolated congregations in the ancient church who didn't have a magistrate around to help them. Now that we got a magistrate around to help us, we've got an exercise of excommunication in politia. We don't need one. We don't need a novus ecclesiasticum senatum. I mean, if you're going to regard the text, you know, the institutions of the ancient church and what is in the evidence of the biblical text, a direct command of Christ himself, is something bound down to historical circumstances, you can't make a very strong demand for its literal application in the present time. I'm certain Calvin would have taken a less easygoing attitude toward the text that he was dealing with. But this is what makes me suspect that his zeal for moral reform and so on comes not from some kind of theological insight or biblical insight, but comes from this kind of general idea that this is what the state is there for and what the church is there for, to make people behave.
As you referred to this really in the paper, but wasn't Wartenberg under Roman law? And didn't you run into some were there not some legal problems here in
the corpus juris,
in the greater excommunication?
I think
there's a real problem there, which explains his relation to the Matthew 18 excommunication, about all these legal problems of inheritance.
He refers to Roman law on some other cases. He can cite it quite adroitly.
Well, didn't Wartenberg come under Roman law at the time that Reuchlin was?
That's a legal problem that didn't keep up high.
In college, but I have a feeling that there's something in that point. There.
Well, that's the case, you see, that it should have been the Duke's second advisor, the Duke himself, the most vehemently wanted this, and the Duke was trying to get out from under this. This was something which his advisors didn't like having to enforce.
Well, it was an embarrassing need.
The Duke kept writing a memorandum saying what we need is a more ecclesiastical form of discipline. And Brent kept saying, no, we don't. I've tried that all before, and it doesn't work.
Our time is up. I wonder if I could ask Mr. Wicks a question yet with reference to the Catholic charge and Luther's subjectivism. From the other side, of course, there was Luther was taking the opposite position. He was defending justification by faith alone to avoid any attempt by the good works which the Anabaptists demanded in the form of purity of life and so on. Do you have any comment on that, or have you looked at that in terms of see how much subjectivism there really is in Luther?
Well, I think in that context, Luther is arguing obviously against a legalistic imposition of good works and stating rather from his own insight into reality of grace that when forgiveness has been received, these good works are going to flow vitally, naturally, enthusiastically, of the famous preface to Romans. Which he defines the activity of faith. But the point I was making is that forgiveness, is quite objectively grounded, and that faith is vis-a-vis very clear and definite word namely absolution. So that, at least to some extent, however you want to criticize Luther's hermeneutics, still in this case, at least in this area, sacramental theology, or I find it very much oriented to an objectively given word that shapes the type of justifying faith that he's talking about, and obviously can ground a polemic view against justification through one's own efforts.
But there's a sense in which it still falls back on something heroic, that you have to somehow muster enough faith to obtain the assurance. The assurance is, even though he says it's objectively given, it's still something that you have to sort of work up to in order to obtain it. And at that point, he's not quite free of the
There's that biblical promise. God deals with us through laws and promises, again and again, and it's there to be and applied. In fact, part reference to the previous question about Luther and discipline, and one of the points is that precisely in these texts in Matthew, he had seen so much the message of forgiveness through the keys, rather than the canonic use of the keys for excommunication, which was very heavy in the tradition of.
Well, we certainly thank you.